Welcome to the show, Dr. Gabor Mate.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. So, Gabor, give us a little just bio about yourself. I know you live in Vancouver. You travel. You write books. You teach. Give us a little bio about, are you married, divorced, kids, no kids?
I've been married 48 years, I think, this year coming up. Wow. We have three adult children, age nearly 41 to nearly 29. And I'm a retired medical doctor. I don't practice medicine anymore, being too busy traveling, speaking, teaching, and also I've written four books, which really all have to do with how human beings develop or don't develop in relationship and the consequences when the optimal relationships are not there to support our development. So those consequences include addiction, include physical illness, including mental illness, and so on. So that is my area of interest, and that's what I've written about.
Great, and that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm really grateful for all that work you've done to help us understand the human condition in relationship and what happens to us when we don't address our relational stress and our attachment. So 48 years, wow, I just want to congratulate you for that. I'm imagining you've been through some challenges there.
Oh, no, it's been smooth sailing. Well, my wife and I talk about that, even though we've only had one wedding, we've had about seven or eight marriages because it goes through such phases and necessarily, you know.
Yeah.
And some have been very, very difficult. And the beauty of it is that each of them can lead to a higher stage of coexisting, not just coexisting, but correlating, co-being. But it is work.
Yeah. Will you take us to one of those challenges just quickly and walk us through, you know, a short synopsis? Because people listening, you know, obviously they have relational challenges, marriage challenges, and they're often looking for like stories as, well, how do you get through this? So can you take us through a challenging moment and how you and your wife got through it?
You mean yesterday morning? Well, the most difficult thing, you know, I think for me, probably for most people, is when you think that how you feel is because of what the other person does. So let's say, well, the example I often give is I come back from a speaking trip. My wife doesn't pick me up at the airport. She's got into her painting. She's preoccupied and she forgets to pick me up. And I experience rage. And underneath the rage, there's hurt. And underneath the hurt, there's this belief that she's doing this to me. Whereas on any kind of reflection, I'm aware that what I'm hurt about is the belief that I'm being abandoned. And that belief of being abandoned has got nothing to do with present experience. Nobody's abandoning me. My wife just got caught up in her painting. But that sense of abandonment and the feelings associated with it, they go back to infancy.
Right.
And so really the constant challenge in relationship is to be in the present moment. And being in the present moment means not reacting from some story and some experience that is really old, old, old stuff.
And how do you get through those?
And this is a daily challenge.
Yep.
For I think everybody in relationship. Because the relationships that we're in are, there's a saying that marriages are made in heaven. And I don't mean that in the religious sense that some creature up there decides who should marry who, and therefore it's sacrosanct from that point of view. No, they're made in heaven in the sense that we always end up in a relationship with somebody who's going to challenge us to get to know ourselves to our fullest capacity. And whatever level of emotional development I was at, so was my wife at that same time. Mm-hmm. Although it might show up differently in our behaviors and manifestations could be very different, we'll be at the same level. And so in a relationship, you either move to higher levels together or you get stuck together. But the sense in which the marriage is made in heaven is in the sense that whoever you marry or whoever you get into a relationship with, partnership with, is perfectly suited to what you need to do.
Yeah, where your work is.
Where your work is, exactly. Yeah. And of course, it's so much easier and more comfortable for me to get caught up in my own resentments and or frustrations and make that about the other person rather than look inside and say, well, what is it that I need to get in touch with internally?
Yeah. I mean, this is such the power of a long-term partnership, because the triggers go so deep, and yet the power of potentially healing some of that is so great if we practice with it in the way you're suggesting here.
Yes, and it helps if the partnership in the present meets some of the needs that perhaps were not met, you know. Like one thing that my wife and I have always done is we've played very well together. Hmm. You know, in fact, we began playing together before we became lovers, you know.
Yeah.
And now it turns out that caring is an important brain system. But so is play an important brain system.
Uh-huh.
And the one supports the other.
Yeah.
So that, and when I think of myself as an infant, I realize that owing to circumstances around my own infancy, I wasn't played with very much. Hmm. That's not something that developed very well in me. And I still find myself somewhat at a loss with young children, you know, like nieces and grandnieces and nephews, just not quite knowing how to play with them, whereas some people just find it so spontaneously easy to play with young kids. Mm-hmm. So the fact that I'm married to somebody who knows how to play with me,
yeah,
has been of tremendous support.
Yeah.
And it helps to create an environment in which it's safer to explore those other places where there's a lot of pain and an unmet need.
Totally. What's an example of one thing you guys have to play well with together over the years? What do you guys, what's a play thing you do?
We dance.
Hmm.
And we just, a lot of humor.
Uh-huh.
a lot of play around words.
My wife and I do that one a lot.
Yeah. My wife Ray also knows how to pop my balloon of self-importance whenever I get overinflated, which it tends to do, you know.
Yeah, well, forgetting to pick you up at the airport is a good one. You come home all high from maybe some engagement, and no one's there for you.
That's exactly what happened. I'd given this talk, standing ovation. I think I'm great. I come home, nobody's there to pick me up.
Yeah, very humbling. Cool. So can you walk us through it's kind of a two-part question. Walk us through like the stress response that happens when we get triggered by someone, our partner mainly, and what's the long-term cost if we don't deal with that stress?
Well, stress is always, at its core, a response to fear. And so we're meant to be stressed. If I'm an evolving hominid out there in the wild, and a saber-toothed tiger comes loping towards me, I better be afraid.
Right.
I better be afraid. And my stress response better be triggered. And a stress response means I'm going to be in survival mode. I'm going to be in fight or flight mode. Now that's not just a psychological emotional state, it's a physiological state. My adrenal gland based on messages from the brain, will release adrenaline and cortisol, which are stress hormones that will strengthen me, make me faster, make me more alert, give me more energy, also that I can fight back or escape. So that's a necessary survival state.
Yeah, to take good care of yourself out in the wild. Yep.
Yeah. What happens is that, of course, our biggest need as infants is caring, being cared for, being protected. And in a broader sense, as humans, we have more complex needs as well, as to be seen for who we are and to be accepted and to be welcomed and to be received. Now, when the environment doesn't give us that, we have fear. Why do we have fear? Because we depend on those relationships for our very survival. Mm-hmm. There's no human life without that caring environment. And our very existence is jeopardized if those qualities are not available to us. Now, in our society, those qualities that parents need to offer their children are quite regardless of what love or commitment the parents have, but those qualities of acceptance and being fully responded to and attuned with and being welcomed and accepted, they're severely compromised. As a parent, my ability to provide those qualities to my children was severely compromised by my own early history and my own failure to develop those capacities, mm-hmm. and compromised also by the values and pressures and stresses of the society that we live in. Now, that means that then we look to our partners to give us all those things that we didn't get.
Yeah.
And when he or she, for their own reasons, is incapable, then we go into a fear mode. And when we go into the fear mode, well, one response to that, of course, is rage, where we go in the attack.
Yep.
And generally, we, no matter how we respond, we go into survival mode. And that's a highly stressed mode physiologically. So now we have high levels of adrenaline and cortisol. And in the short term, in a real situation of danger, they help us survive. In a situation of a relationship where we trigger into those states, we start to fight or we withdraw and we escape, both of which undermine a relationship. So here we are wanting the relationship to succeed because we need that and we want it. But our own physiological responses, triggered by our emotional interpretations of what's going on, undermine the very relationship that we're seeking.
Yeah.
Not to mention, in the long term, when those hormones are triggered and released over the long term, they make us physically ill and mentally ill. So a lot of physical illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis, autoimmune disease in general, cancers and so on, are often triggered by life stresses, much of which stresses actually have to do with our relationships. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of interesting studies about, what happens in marriages, for example, when there is attuned communication or when there isn't attuned communication. And the degree of anxiety or even illness that occurs in the lack of attuned communication.
Yeah, so this is a big deal because we could develop disease and illness, and the stress, adds to the pile, and then it compounds, I imagine, over the years. So what, all your books, essentially, to me, I've read three of them, and I'm actually about halfway through the Hold On To Your Kids. My wife and I are reading that together currently. Yeah. And the basic message I get is exactly what you're talking about here, is that when we're not dealing with the primary attachment relationships, let's say parent-child, we grow up into this adult life and we're compromised then, and now we have all these adaptive strategies to get our needs met, much of which hurt us, but we're just doing the best we can to try to get that connection again, and all the symptoms come from an inability, it seems like, to deal with this fear and this stress response and all the what happens in the body.
Well, yes, and the strategies that we develop as young children to get our needs met when we don't get them met automatically and directly, while those strategies may have helped us survive in the short term, in the long term, they undermine us. And so a young child, for example, might learn, and not consciously and not deliberately, but might learn to manipulate a situation by being overly emotional. Mm-hmm. So when their emotions weren't attended to, there's a number of strategies the child can develop. One is to shut down emotions because it's too painful to be alone with those emotions. When you shut down emotion, given the unity of mind and body and the inseparability of our psychology from our physiology, a unity, by the way, which the medical profession for the most part utterly ignores. Mm-hmm. But given that unity, when you shut down emotion, you're also affecting your immune system and you're affecting your nervous system and so on. So the repression of emotion, which is a survival strategy, then becomes a source of physiological illness later on.
Yep.
Or on the other hand, a child learns not to repress emotion, but to overexpress, because they have to manipulate the situation to get their needs met.
Right, to be overly loud or cute or funny or emotional, yeah, in some way.
Now, that means they're always looking to the environment to somehow rescue them from themselves. Hmm. What does that do? It alienates people.
Yeah.
So that manipulation, which is not at all conscious on the part of the individual, even when they become adult, they're still not conscious of it. Nobody in the emotional sense says to themselves, I'm going to manipulate somebody else right now for my needs.
Right.
They just do it automatically. They don't even realize it's a manipulation. But from their partner, it evokes a resistance.
Yeah, it's like a retardant.
That's exactly what it is. Now, there are conscious manipulations. Who does that? Politicians do. Corporations do it. You know, where they know the facts of a situation, but they're going to manipulate their intended audience for the purpose of selling them something. But in personal relationships, as much as we talk about somebody being manipulative, that's hardly conscious. It's usually a learned, I should say, a developed survival technique. But then the very technique that is intended to bring the other closer to you so that you can actually feel more connected and more alive actually undermines the possibility of getting your needs met. It leaves you feeling more alone.
Yeah.
And again, we know that being alone, I don't mean being alone, being emotionally alone. I enjoy being alone a lot, but nobody enjoys being lonely.
Yeah.
So very often the very things we do to bring other people closer leave us more lonely, and we're not even aware of it.
Right, and then we wonder why our marriage sucks, or why our partner is a pain in the ass, or why our life isn't happy or fulfilled.
And why the world isn't treating us the way we'd like to be treated. Mm-hmm. Well, the good news with all of that is that, and, you know, and not to mention then, we don't get our needs met, and then what happens? As I show in my book on addiction in the realm of hunger goes, then what happens is then we try and seek external sources.
Yeah.
To fill that emptiness and to soothe ourselves.
And we get a temporary hit and it kind of feels good, so we keep doing it, but it doesn't last.
Well, that's exactly what an addiction is.
Yeah.
temporary hit that makes you feel good, but doesn't last, in fact, creates negative consequences. So that the more emotionally bereft we are, and the more then our survival strategies that we developed as children fail us, the more then we like to turn to the outside, therefore become addicted.
Yeah.
And then the more suffering we create for ourselves. And that's why it's so unfair. So when Jesus says that to whom that have, more shall be given. And from those who have little, even more will be taken away. It seems such an unfair statement. But it's just how life works. Mm-hmm. Is that the more we lack emotionally, psychologically, the more we end up depriving ourselves. Until we realize that we're doing it. And the good news is that we are, as human beings, capable of that learning, as I'm sure you know, and all the clients you work with must also experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's the good news here. The silver lining is, of course, that this is all feedback, right? And if somehow we have the wherewithal to listen to the feedback, it might wake us up to then seek help or a different way.
The difficulty is, of course, in listening to the feedback is that one of the defenses we develop is not
listening to the feedback.
Is not listening to the feedback because, as children, young infants, it's so painful.
Yeah, it's threatening, right?
Yeah. So then we end up evolving a wall, a brick wall between ourselves and actual reality, and then on that brick wall we project our own scenarios. And we don't realize, and it's just, that's why it's so hard to learn from negative examples, that you're so defended against the lesson.
Yeah. Oh God, totally. Okay, so.
You know what? When, sometimes when I ponder this thing, I wonder how any of us manage states even halfway sane at all.
I know, right?
All our pain and difficult experiences can also be turned towards transformation.
Yeah. So you're, let's transition into that. You're, to me, on a pioneer here in someone who's willing to stand up and just say what is so, which is what you notice and what you observe, and which had to be hard in sort of a, you know, quite the intense medical field that is in maybe denial. It seems like a lot of the solutions and treatments that are traditionally done for all this pain that we're talking about, primarily this relational stress, this attachment injuries, is inadequate for the healing process to occur. And you've explored, you know, way alternative stuff from ayahuasca. You've talked about Imbogaine and different things to help us get at some of this stuff. What do you recommend, and what is your current, what would you tell us who's listening? Okay, this is the problem. How do we individually, in our own marriages, for example, first maybe, deal with this? What can we do? And what kind of treatment can we seek out? What kind of support can we go get?
I'm just watching my mind as you unravel the question, and so many different things come up. So let me go back to the beginning and see if I can get to the relationship. The first thing to realize is that whatever issue you're dealing with, whether it's rheumatoid arthritis, whether it's recurrent migraine headaches or cluster headaches, whether it's even cancer,
Hashimoto's, whatever, yeah.
Whether it's thyroid disease, whether it's chronic asthma, any chronic illness, is a manifestation of the mind-body unity, the unity of physiology and psychology, not one or the other. So that in medical terms, the diagnosed disease is itself a symptom.
Right.
And so, along with whatever treatment you might wish to receive, or and the same is true as mental illness, you know, addiction, anxiety, depression, ADHD, whatever it is. So these are not themselves the primary problems. They're manifestations of a problem.
Yeah.
And that problem has to do with actually how you relate to yourself and to the world. And so that along with whatever treatment you choose, the recognition of the particular diagnosis or issue or problem should open up an inquiry about your relationship to yourself and to the world. And it's in that inquiry that you're going to find the healing, mm-hmm. in addition to whatever treatment you get.
So you got to be willing, I'm hearing, to see and inquire about yourself and how you're impacted by the world.
And that's right. And how you create the world that you live in based on early programming. Mm-hmm. And so that now, how you pursue that, whether you pursue it through psychotherapy and or spiritual practices and or yoga and or various shamanic healing practices and or mindful awareness and or EMDR and or EFT, those are practical issues based on what you're drawn to and what's available to you. Mm-hmm. But the overall question is that inquiry into yourself and your relationship to the world. And the main manifestation of the world, speaking of my own experience, my wife keeps bringing me back to this, that as much as I can go off and do retreats and shamanic experiences and you know, as much as I can do the psychological reading and the self-work, where it really plays out fundamentally is in my relationship with her.
Yep.
Because that's where I'm going to get triggered.
Yep. Yeah.
That's also where I can get partnered. Mm-hmm. That's also when my partner will get triggered. And then I have to deal with my own reactions to her being triggered.
Yep.
So ultimately, all of these areas are important, but it all plays out if you're in a primary relationship. If you're in a committed primary relationship, ultimately, that's where it all plays out.
Yeah.
And that's where much of the work needs to be done.
Well, I love that because I've done lots of spiritual practice. I've been in spiritual communities, lots of different communities. And it seems like you, wherever you go, there you are. And you can't, you know, you get in relationship. But like, I can live with any proclaimed enlightened person. And after a couple months, I'm going to see all their shit come out. Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to trigger them and they're going to trigger me. And here we are. So I love personally the healing modalities that are relational in nature.
Well, that's right. Because we were wounded in relationship in the first place, going back to the womb and shortly afterwards, we can also heal in the relationship. Now, that doesn't mean that you rely on the relationship to heal you. It means that you do the self-work in relationship.
Yeah.
So that the other person cannot be and should not be your savior, except insofar as they can help you find yourself.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm personally really committed to this. I'm starting a relationship school to help bring relational empathy and awareness and education to kids and obviously grown-ups here. Because I feel like it's so, it was the missed class, right, in school. I never got the class on how to actually deal with my shit in relationship to other people.
Well, I mean, when you think of how human beings used to be educated, and I never get tired of pointing out that for eons of human existence, we lived in an entirely different context than we do now. So learning and development and education were not formalized, but they were intrinsic to the way of life.
Yeah.
And that way of life involved, I'm just reading a book on pygmies called The Forest People. Hmm. And the children live with the adults 24/7. You know, and so they see their parents relating to each other, resolving issues, having sex even. And which is shocking to our modern ears, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
They live communally so that children have many adult caregivers. And so they develop a sense of themselves, not as isolated individuals, but as integral members of a community. So the formal teaching is very minimal in that context, because kids literally see and they develop under the care of adults who model how to be.
And they're learning through their experience every day.
That's exactly it. They start to climb trees before they even know how to walk sometimes, you know? So in our education, of course, which has been formalized and narrowed to the intellectual realm, those relational learnings and the communal learnings and the procedural learnings are by and large ignored.
Yeah.
So what we call education is a really narrow slice. Now, I don't say it's not necessary in modern life, but it's certainly not sufficient and not even the most important thing. And the reason it's not the most important thing is that when children know how to respect themselves and others, and when they're not hurt, therefore they don't have to shut down their natural naive curiosity about the world, it's so much easier to teach them everything else. So that the intellectual learning and the procedural learning become almost automatic. So a child who's curious and open-minded and relationally secure, you don't have to work very hard to teach them. Mm-hmm. You just have to provide them with the materials that they need to learn. Whereas when you ignore the emotional basis of cognitional learning, it's so hard to drive knowledge into the minds of kids.
That's what it's like, driving knowledge into the minds of kids.
So if you're starting a school for relational learning, I trust it'll not be, now we're going to take a course in relational learning. It's going to have to be in the context that you set up and in the relational dynamics between the students and the teachers.
Yeah.
That's what's going to be the teaching.
Great. What else? How else do we get relational education to parents and kids in a way that they're like, yeah, they're psyched because this is just part of my life?
You know, that book that you're reading right now that I co-wrote, Hold On To Your Kids?
Yep.
There's actually a chapter on education and how kids learn. And what it comes down to is what interferes with learning is fear and emotional shutdown. So when children are afraid of the teachers or of afraid in life in general, the brain is always trying to deal with, how do I get myself safe? That's not a mode in which learning happens very well. So absolute emotional security is the key. Play is the key. As I said earlier, play is an important brain system. It's present in animals. It's present in mammals. You see the play that happens with kittens or lion cubs or baby bears or puppies. Play is a very serious thing.
Yeah.
In a sense that it's necessary preparation for life. There needs to be a lot more play in the school setting.
Mm-hmm.
Not scripted play, but spontaneous play where the teacher learns from the student.
Right. Imagine that.
And there needs to be the kind of safety where the child doesn't have to shut down. That also means that the child's primary relationships have to be with nurturing adults, not with other kids.
Yeah, that's what I'm really getting from your book.
Because other kids can never provide that sense of safety.
Well, in the peer orientation thing, like you said, that's what happens, is this thing you guys call peer orientation, and they start to look to people that don't know what they're talking about for guidance, other kids.
And then you can see the terrible influence of the internet and so on, where it's just peer orientation gone mad. So you people now turn to Facebook to have quote unquote friends. Yeah. And they turn to Facebook to be liked.
Yeah.
Why are they doing that? Because they're not getting that friendship, that genuine friendship, and that sense of being accepted in real life. That's why it's so addictive.
Yeah.
So if I were to run any kind of a school with kids, I would have very limited and very supervised access to internet. Mm-hmm. And I would not have kids with cell phones and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That way they're naturally relating to each other, right?
I'd have them relating to one another through nurturing adults. So there's many, many things.
Sure.
Focus on the relationship.
Well, sometime I'd love to pick your brain another time. I'm just aware of the time. And it's been a real pleasure. And I really, really just want to appreciate you for all the pioneering work you've done to be a voice of saying, really a voice of reason and just logic saying, guys, this is going on here. And I want to name it, particularly all the symptomology that arises from our relational stress and from ADD to mental illness to the diseases you mentioned. It just feels really, I'm just deeply grateful. And I know a lot of people in my world feel the same way. So thank you so much for what you're doing for the planet and for human beings.
Well, my gosh, what can I say? Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm really glad my work has got out there to reach a lot of people, and thanks a lot for your interest.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, where can people find you?
Well, my website is www.drgabormate.com, and there's chapters of my books available there. I have many YouTube videos that people can watch. I didn't post them myself. People just video my talks and they post them.
Oh, and read his books. They're really good, and especially if you want just a practical, deeper understanding of how the physiology and psychology work together. I think you've done an excellent job explaining that.
Great.
Cool. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason. Take care. Bye-bye.
So one action step you can do right now is, if you're a parent or not, I would strongly encourage you to get Hold On to Your Kids, the book or the audiobook. Read it or listen to it. If you want to understand more about human attachment and why it's so crucial for us to have attachment figures in our life. And when we don't have, say, a parent or parental attachment figure is compromised, we'll go to the peer group. And this is why so often people don't develop, is they go to their peer group and stay stuck because they're attaching to their peer group and really not growing. This is why it's so essential, if you want to be a smart couple, is to find growth development oriented people so that you can go to the next level in your development. You can attach and bond with people who are where you want to be, as opposed to staying stuck where you are. So, man, I'm just, now that I continue to interview these attachment wizards like Stan Tatkin and Gabor and Reed, Daniel Siegel, and so many others, I'm getting a huge insights for my own parenting and my own life. In fact, right now my relationship with my son is going through another transformation. And one thing, when he acts out, essentially whenever he acts out, it's because of I'm not feeling connected to him, or he's not feeling connected to me. And that's the attachment. And so all the parenting books or any advice is going to fall short if I'm not attending to that. And that's the most subtle yet obvious thing that I can correct. And if my attachment was compromised as a kid, that's going to be harder for me as a parent. So anyway, I could go on and on here, and I probably will in a future episode. But I'll leave it there. Go check out that book, whether you're a parent or not, because it's going to help you understand how we attach to adults. And it's really, really good.